More than a century before the Stonewall riots that marked a new beginning for the gay rights movement, Cincinnati had a rich queer subculture. A new book called Cincinnati Before Stonewall, The Untold Queer History of the Queen City, explores the city's forgotten past. You're tuned to Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. I'm Lucy May. Author and public historian Jacob Hogue joins me in this recorded interview to talk about his book and the LGBTQ people who helped shape Cincinnati. Thanks so much for being here, Jake.
Thank you so much for having me.
I'm delighted. I really enjoyed your book. It's called Cincinnati Before Stonewall, and it is way before Stonewall.
Yes, it
because
is. Yes.
You start with stories of LGBTQ soldiers in the Civil War. Tell us about Julius Dexter.
Yeah, I found the 106th Ohio Volunteer Infantry had to have been one of the queerest regiments in the Civil War. The first story I found that kind of told me that I had a book here was the story of Lieutenant Julius Dexter. He was the son of Edmund Dexter, the famous whiskey empire family. I actually have a bottle of his whiskey at my house now.
Fancy.
Still out there, yeah. But yeah, I found an obituary for this man. And it was the wording of the obituary that told me something strange was going on here. When he died in the late 19th century, he left his giant mansion, all of its contents inside of the house, and an annuity to this one man. Who I later found out he had lived with for close to 40-something years.
Wow.
Consistently. It was the wording of the obituary that got me. It says after they listed all the things that he was getting, his estate and everything, it says, but he was simply an intimate friend of Mr. Dexter.
Oh, wow.
And that just seemed like they saw the strangeness in what was happening too, and they chose to make that, they chose that for a reason. So I started digging into it. I went into census and directory records. I found out, like I said, these two had lived together their entire lives. After the Civil War, Eugene Bliss, which is his boyfriend's name, moves back to Cincinnati after attending Harvard. They were all Harvard law graduates. Yeah, I found that they never left one another. And then I got lucky because I found out that they were men of means and importance. So when they died, someone collected all their things and put it at the Cincinnati Museum Center. So I was able to go through all their diaries. And I mean, I felt like a creep because I know so much about them. But I read their diaries. I read their correspondence with their friends. And it was incredible you knew right away that these two were in love with each other.
Well, because some of their friends even referred to them as Mr. and Mrs. Dexter,
yes,
right?
That's correct. Yeah, they're... In several letters, I saw that they mentioned Mr. and Mrs. Dexter. And in one piece of correspondence, Eugene Bliss answers as Mrs. Dexter.
Aww.
So yeah, it was pretty cool. Their friends seemed to know what was going on,
mm-hmm.
Especially Mariah Longworth Storr, who's the founder of Rookwood Pottery. She hosted Oscar Wilde when he came to town, and I knew something was up with her. But the letter that where she mentions, there's a letter where she pretty much blanketly expresses that Bliss is a homosexual.
Yeah.
And that's when I knew, like, all right, I can put this in the book. I pieced enough evidence together because that's really what you're doing. You're building a story with breadcrumbs, right?
How much of their ability to live that life together, to live together for this 40-year time period, basically their whole adult lives, how much of that was because of their status, their race, and their wealth?
100% all of it, yes. Mm-hmm. They were public-facing people who were in the spotlight all of the time. I find it hard to believe that people did not speculate about their relationship. And there is some evidence to suggest that they were kind of discriminated against. In 1879, they were left out of the Blue Book, which was the city's social registry. They had the most fashionable house on the street. They lived in the most fashionable district on 4th Street. There's no reason why they shouldn't have been on there. You could attribute almost all of them being able to survive that way to their race and their privilege. And the way that we're able to remember them is based off of that as well, right? Because if they had been poor, if no one had created an archive for them, we would never have these stories.
Right. Well, and their lives were very different from another Civil War veteran you wrote about, Henry Fisher.
Yes, Henry Fisher. This story, I mean, it's so crazy because sometimes you get more answers or more questions than you get answers. And that's certainly the case with Henry Fisher. You know, I got his entire compressed military file. So I feel like I know a lot about this person, but at the same time, every time I found out something, I'm like, wait, why is that happening? But yeah, Henry Fisher was a German immigrant. He was about 25 by the time he immigrated to the United States. He had to have been in some ways a part of the German revolutions that were going on in 1848. So he would have been like one of the 1848ers. He serves in the 106th Ohio Volunteer Infantry. He's actually caught and captured by a Confederate cavalry leader, John Morgan, who was a famed Confederate leader. He's actually captured and then paroled. He spends the rest of his time kind of guarding Union supplies and different things like that. But his story isn't resurrected until 1887, when he applies for aid at a veterans home in Dayton. It was the National Disabled Home for Volunteer Soldiers. It was a sprawling complex. He had every reason to want to go there. But when he went, they gave him a medical examination. And at first they said that he can't be entered in because he's a woman. But then he went back to have a second opinion or something, and they announced that he was both half male and half female. Mm. Now, there are certainly intersex people being documented all across the 19th century. It's hard to know what Henry Fisher was for sure. I know that they lived their life as a man. That's why I said that. That's why I called them that. But it is also possible that it was a woman in male attire that was in the Civil War. So some of these stories you're never really going to know, except that they were very, very queer for their time. And that kind of led me on more research into intersex identity in Cincinnati. I found out that there was a man by the name of Joshua Whittington Underhill who kind of helped pioneer the classification mechanisms for how we talk about intersex people. They called them hermaphrodites then. Mm-hmm. But yeah, he was a crazy character. He had a public meltdown in 1888. He had a cocaine addiction that was like the first major one in Cincinnati that was like sensationalized.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah, that didn't make the book, but it's exciting. Yeah.
Maybe a follow-up book.
Maybe a follow-up. Yeah.
Well, Henry Fisher's life was sensationalized too once this discovery was made, or once the medical staff announced this man as a woman, or however they decided to characterize it. And it seems like that was a common theme among a lot of these stories you found about people who were maybe born as women but living as men, or born as men and living as women. It must have been incredibly difficult for them to live their lives.
Yeah, every second of every day would have been a careful performance. It would have, I can't imagine the bravery that it took for some of these people to live their lives, because, you know, back then it would have cost them anything if they were found out. Very few people in my book stuck around after their case made headlines. And that's another complication for studying queer history, is that if they stuck around, they were kind of stupid. You know, if you were outed and you stayed in Cincinnati, good things weren't going to happen to you. So.
Yeah. Well, one way that people threaded the needle was through performing as male impersonators or female impersonators, people we'd now call drag kings or drag queens.
Yes.
Tell us about some of Cincinnati's famous early performers, because Cincinnati had quite a few.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. Cincinnati had a dizzying maze of concert halls and saloons and places for these people to perform. There were drag kings and queens, or male and female impersonators, and America's early theatrical days before baseball. Before the first pitch was thrown at a baseball game, there were gender impersonators traipsing on stage, cross-dressing. That's just a fact. It really takes off with minstrelsy in the 1830s and 1870s, 1880s. It goes on longer than that, but that was really its heyday. So that complicates the narrative, right? Because a lot of these gender impersonators throughout the 19th century were grotesquely imitating and characterizing Black people as all these stereotypes. And it was really, really horrible. But that started to change with the emergence of this character called the prima donna character. And the prima donna character was vain, obsessed with themselves. They really created the basis for the modern drag queen now. Their outfits and their hair and their sentimentality was foremost among what was happening. Whereas before, they were wench characters, or they were only supposed to be funny. They weren't supposed to make you feel anything, or want to be them, or want to sleep with them, or anything like that, right? That changed with a person by the name of Only Leon. He was one of the first major female impersonators. He was so convincing that people refused to believe that he was a man. And he moved with his boyfriend to Cincinnati in 1865 or 1866, right around the end of the Civil War. They opened up the Academy of Music on 4th Street. It later burns to the ground, so they don't stay here very long. But it was people like Only Leon who publicly dated men. Everybody knew that him and Edwin Kelly were together. It was gender impersonators like that that kind of helped increase the suspicion of that what these people were doing on stage was emblematic of what they did off stage. Mm-hmm. And that's certainly the case for my favorite drag performer of all time, which is Annie Hendel. Annie Hendel, also known as the Great Hendel, was the country's first drag king or male impersonator. They came here in the 1860s, were wildly popular. They moved to Cincinnati in 1872, again in the 1880s. And then I think that they remained in Cincinnati at the end of their life from 1896 to roughly the early 20th century. Mm. So Cincinnati remained a constant in this very, very queer person's life. They married so many women that I've lost track of how many women that they've married. Yes. But yeah, they were one of the biggest celebrities in the country, but their overt queerness kind of threatened everything. They kept marrying women. And while their first few marriages were never reported about, we found them later. Me and an author named Gillian Roger. In 1886, she gets married again. They get married again. I'm never sure which pronoun to use for Handel because they move back and forth. But yeah, Handel gets married in 1886, and a newspaper reporter, like a pesky newspaper reporter, crashes the wedding reception and sees this very strange affair and goes up to Handel and asks, like, what's going on? And in order to maybe not get arrested or to get the reporter to go away, Handel says, I'm a man, leave me alone. So then the newspaper reporter goes back to the press and says, there's a male impersonator in the city. So yeah, it's a very interesting story. That case didn't make Handel stop dressing stop marrying women. But yeah, they constantly came back to Cincinnati, and they were living with a woman by the name of Jenny Kramer at the end of their life in Cincinnati. And they were actually living as Charles Handel in the city directory, Lucy. Mm,
yes. Wow.
Isn't that fantastic?
It is. Well, I'm talking this recorded interview with Jacob Hoag, author of the new book, Cincinnati Before Stonewall, The Untold Queer History of the Queen City. Okay, so Jake, you write that Cincinnati became a hub for queer subcultures in the 19th century. Talk a little bit more about that and how that existed alongside these Victorian gender norms.
Yeah, you see it play out in newspaper reporting. There was a concentration on Vine Street, it seemed, to where drag performers were hanging outside of the bar or inside of the bar in drag off stage. And that was a rule that you weren't allowed to break. Now, Cincinnati didn't have a masquerade law until the 1970s. It was actually the last city in the country to enact one. Huh. No one that lives in Cincinnati is surprised by that. but they didn't have a masquerade law, but they'd still arrest you for doing it. It was such a violation of norms that it didn't even need a law. But what I kept finding at places like Young's Concert Hall on Vine Street or Peter's Concert Hall on Vine Street was that there was consistently raids happening on these places because of the gender impersonators, because of their overtly sexual nature. And it kind of showed me that, you know, for a period of close to 10 years, maybe even 10 or 20 years, that these performers were hanging out in the same areas. Hmm. That is the formation of a subculture. It's the flagrant violation of gender norms. There was a person by the name of Pete Shaw who was kind of the prima donna of Cincinnati's OTR concert halls. And you can read the anxiety that people were feeling about gender performers through the way that they talk about him, through the way that they kind of mock him. It's kind of hard to read sometimes because they are mocking these gender impersonators a lot. As, you know, theories of sexual inversion and all these studies started to come out in the late 19th century, it kind of put a target on people's backs who were not acquiescent to gender norms. So it kind of gave a scientific basis to say that this is bad, right?
Yeah. Well, and you were talking about the research that happened in Cincinnati related to intersex people who were historically called hermaphrodites. It seems like a lot of this history, when it wasn't about pathologizing people, which you document very clearly a lot of it was purposefully hidden. So can you talk a little bit more about just how you found all this stuff?
Yeah, one of the first things I did was, after I found the story of Henry Fisher, I was so curious about intersex identity because it's a part of our acronym, but we don't really talk about it. And I think that the existence of intersex people challenges so much of right-wing ideology around sex and gender. I mean, it stands in the face of this dual system, right? And I found out that there was a Dr. Nasty, there was a Dr. Taylor, and then Dr. Underhill, the three of the major people doing these kinds of, they were preemptive, like, it was called sex realignment surgeries on infants and people who had like amorphous genitalia and things like that. But the fact that that was going on all the way back then showed people that there wasn't just a clear male-female divide, right? So I found these things through the Cincinnati Medical Lancet journals and things like that. I saw a guy by the name of J.W. Underhill, who I mentioned earlier, who had the famous cocaine addiction. He published a study called Two Hermaphrodite Sisters. And then there was another one called Both and Neither, which is that's a very poignant thing. Because when a woman by the name of Mary Pearson was arrested in December of 1890, that's exactly the verbiage that a newspaper reporter said. They said they arrested a woman wearing male attire, and upon further examination, she was both male and female. She was both and neither.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah. So we've been having these conversations for a lot longer than people think.
Yeah. A lot of the stories of queerness at the time were tied to tragedy, too. You write about young people who turned to crime to survive or who made suicide pacts when they couldn't live as their authentic selves. Was the message that was being broadcast through newspaper accounts and other accounts of the time that was the message that queerness was misery?
Yes, 100%. Yeah, there would have been no other way to present it. In Victorian culture, you know, you had the Anthony Comstock laws after 1873, which, you know, if you were writing sympathetically about a gay relationship, you would have likely violated Comstock laws. Mm. That's number one. Number two is that, yeah, bad endings were a prerequisite for queer people to be introduced into mainstream literature and society. So that's reflected in books that you read at that time period. There's one very poignant book called A Marriage Below Zero, written by Alan Dale in 1890. By 1891, it factors into an obscenity trial of Samuel Gruber on Fifth Street, and it's found at the Hebrew Union College, where two rabbinical students committed suicide. And The Enquirer called the book a bright and pleasing book, despite the fact that it was about a homosexual relationship, because the main character at the end dies in atonement for his sins. And that's the same way in newspaper reporting and things like that. They would never report about a lovely gay couple down the street. It had to have been that lovely gay couple down the street where one was the victim of the other. That's also how it was framed. A gay relationship, two consenting adults being together, was so far out of what people could conceptualize back then that they had to see it as if there was a brute, is what they called them, brutes, and then a victim. Hmm. So they often act as if the people in the relationship were younger or more fallible than they actually were. And in the case of the Hebrew Union College double suicide, they acted as if the boy hypnotized the other one into killing himself.
Well, I don't want to make it sound like your book is only filled with those stories of tragedy and misery, because you also chronicle stories of strength and defiance.
Yes.
Tell us about Mary Ann Jefferson.
Yes. Mary Ann Jefferson is one of my favorite. She's one of my favorite people I've ever researched. And it's because I was able to see and find the humanity in her, despite the newspaper that covered the case, dehumanizing them and being horrible at every step of the way. Mary Ann Jefferson was a Black trans woman who lived in Cincinnati's most dangerous neighborhood. It was known as Rat Row. It was right where, like, kind of like where the baseball stadium and stuff would be today, which is kind of funny. I'm actually going there today for the Reds game. Mary Ann Jefferson, she lived along the riverfront for over 15 years before her death in 1889. And when she was, you know, sick and taken to the women's reception room at the city hospital, Dr. Hayes, after examining her, found that she was not to the manner born, as they said. Hmm. This was a Black trans woman who was known as a sex worker along the levee. So it's kind of funny to me that, you know, when the newspaper reporter is asking everybody what's going on, everyone's acting shocked. Those two things don't really make sense to me. What's likely is that people preferred women like Mary Ann. Some people did. And one of those people was a guy by the name of Peter Jefferson, who actually married Mary Ann Jefferson. Mary Ann Jefferson's original name was Mary Ann Johnson. And despite being a sex worker and a career criminal, she found love. And they lived on East Front Street together. And the craziest part about the case is I found that Mary's own mother was reported to have attended the wedding between the two. Isn't that amazing?
Yeah.
Yeah.
What was it that you felt like you could find out about her strength and resilience despite the way she was characterized in these, you know, newspaper accounts?
Yeah, well, I found, you know, she found love. She had remaining familial connections with her family members, with her mother, right? There's a writer named Lefcidio O'Hearn who wrote about Cincinnati's riverfront in the 1870s. And he said that the people there possessed a sort of cosmopolitan tolerance that wasn't seen in the rest of the city. And that reverberated with me in the story of a woman who was 6 foot tall, who was described as being fearsome and huge, and that she could live her life in the city's most dangerous neighborhood and only be outed upon her death when someone else did it. A white guy in the hospital outed her. No one in her town ever turned her in or said anything to her. And I think that's powerful. And I think that speaks to, one, it spits in the face of this idea of a homophobic Black community, which I heard constantly during my research. Like, you're not going to find anything there. It's actually the opposite. If you look at my chapter on the queer West End, there was a vibrant queer Black subculture that was destroyed with urban renewal initiatives.
Yeah. Well, you write about the important places that were sanctuaries for people. What were some of the standouts?
The standout by far was the Downstairs Club, also known as the Jacobo. It's the weirdest little place you could ever imagine. It doesn't make any sense. It's out it's out in Kenton County off the 3L Highway. It's the strangest place for a gay bar ever, but it was run by a guy by the name of Jack Speaks and Helen Speaks. They had a gay son who was known as the darling of the Downstairs Club. He was also known as the gay gangster of Newport, but I don't know if they were actually super involved with the mob or if they were just connected some ways. Yeah, the Jacobo was the only dance club for hundreds and hundreds of miles. People would visit from New York and Los Angeles and say that this place stands out because men can dance with men, women can dance with women. There were gay bars that had existed since at least the 1920s in Cincinnati, but I doubt you could actually have open forms of affection with one another. Mm-hmm. The Downstairs Club being where it was in a basement tucked into a hill and an unassuming, you know, building, it kind of let people let their hair down. And there were drag pageants there as early as 1953. There was a trans woman by the name of Terry Noel who got her start there. She was the most beautiful woman I've ever seen in my entire life. So she handily won this drag pageant and then went on to pursue this amazing career. But she got her start at the Downstairs Club, as did the city's first gay activist, a woman by the name of Mary Ann Lederer. Mary Ann Lederer started a gay rights organization in 1967, but she got her start at the Downstairs Club as well. So it seems to be a place where a lot of the important characters in my book converged.
Yeah. Okay, well, in your book, you write, if today's LGBTQ+ movement is symbolized by the rainbow, this book represents the storm that preceded it. I just love the way you phrase that, first of all.
Thank you.
Say more about what you mean by that and why it was so important to you to really document this storm.
Yeah, there's. I do want to warn readers that this isn't always a fun read. A lot of the stories, for the reasons I mentioned earlier with the bad endings idea, these stories are naturally going to end in a bad way a lot of the time. So, yeah, I didn't want people to pick up this book and think that we're all skipping towards the horizon of progress, you know, because that's not necessarily what's happening. And that's especially true when you look at race. You know, race constantly played a factor in shaping the story in ways that I didn't want it to. I wanted us all to skip off into the sunset holding hands. But the more I looked into it, race became this elephant in the room. So that's an uncomfortable part of the book, is confronting our own racism, you know, our sanctuaries. Every book in here was every bar in this place that was white was segregated, all of them. It says a lot about gay culture that there are more gay bars during segregation than there are today. Mm. It says a lot about our culture that... It says a lot about, the nuances of minority identity when, you know, female impersonation got its start portraying black people as, apes and different horrible things, you know. We have to confront those things because you see the patterns existing today where our activist organizations have very few black members, where if you go into the bar, the black people are hanging out with the black people mostly and the whites are hanging out with the white people. I mean, you see it in churches, you see it in schools. You know, unless we confront it, we're not ever going to actually have, a more unified society.
Yeah. So what do you think we can learn from how we treated marginalized people more than a century ago?
Yeah. One, within our own communities, we can see that, our own shortcomings, right? I always say that, if we're not marching together, then progress is a crawl. And I think that's true all throughout queer history. You know, the activist organizations that tried to start in the 1960s and 1970s faltered because they didn't give everyone a seat at the table. Activist organizations in the bars were still very, very segregated, not only by race, but by gender. It wasn't until the 80s, late 70s, early 80s, when Cincinnati's activist apparatus was unified. Gay, lesbian, trans, black, white. It still was not great. But that's kind of when they started to actually make headway. That's when they started to get things changed and in city government and things like that. So, our unification, the success of us unifying has been obvious, right?
Yeah. Well, I've been talking with public historian Jacob Hoag. His new book is called Cincinnati Before Stonewall, The Untold Queer History of the Queen City. Thanks so much for your time today, Jacob. It's been a pleasure, and I really enjoyed your book.
Thank you. I'm such a big fan. This is honestly a dream come true.
You've been listening to Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. Our producer is Selena Reeder. Associate producer is Harper Carlton. Technical director is Carlos Lopez Cornu. I'm Lucy May. Thanks for listening.